You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 81, Leviticus 21 and 22. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good.
Good. It's the new year, so happy new year.
It is. Happy new year.
You have any resolutions? You're going to quit smoking or?
Yeah, I'm not a big resolution guy. You know, yeah,
me either.
I don't do anything that, of any real interest that I have to quit.
Yeah, I'd probably
have I can't say I'm going to quit reading, or something like that.
I'd probably have to quit my coffee consumption, but that's not going to happen. So if I could take the caffeine and inject it straight in somehow, I probably would. That's my only.
So you should be living in the Pacific Northwest then, because that's all they do here is drink coffee.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
true.
I mean, I don't drink coffee, so I guess I'm missing something. But my wife's really into it.
You drink tea though, correct?
Yeah.
So you get your caffeine through tea, so it's.
Yeah, but the coffee drinkers say it's not the same, so I'll take their word for it.
True. I'll have to agree with them.
I don't tremble at all if I'm not drinking.
Oh, yeah. I wake up shaking. I start shaking. No, I'm just kidding. But I do get headaches if I take a day or two off, which is not good.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right, well, we're doing two chapters again. Again, closing in on finishing Leviticus. I'll give everybody a moment again to wipe away the tear that I'm sure is forming. Here we are, Leviticus 21 and 22, and I'm still poking fun at Leviticus, you know, doing Leviticus. But I actually got a good bit of feedback from it. I've liked it. People seem to like it, so, you know, hey. You know, why not? Here we are. And I hope today, again, we learned something. We're going to take two chapters, 21 and 22. And there's actually going to be one thing I sort of park on for the most part. I mean, we'll hit more than one thing. But believe it or not, we're going to get into the tattoo question. This is a question I actually have gotten an email several times about what I think about tattooing. And people always take you to Leviticus. And there was something in Leviticus 19 that I could have brought up then and gone into the tattooing thing, but there was plenty to cover in that previous episode. So I'm going to pick it up here because there's something in Leviticus 21 that references back to Leviticus 19. So this will be the episode. We can talk about that. So having said that, let's just jump in here to Leviticus 21 and start reading. We'll pick up a few things and work our way to the sort of centerpiece for the episode. So Leviticus 21 says, "And the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, no one shall make himself unclean for the dead among his people, except for his closest relatives, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, or his virgin sister, who is near to him because she had no husband. For her he may make himself unclean." Now, this, let's just throw in the fourth verse. He shall not make himself unclean as a husband among his people and so profane himself. Now, these first four verses are about whether they're essentially about, okay, since contact with the dead makes you unclean. We talked about this earlier in Leviticus, whether it's a dead human being, a dead carcass of an animal, contact with death or with the dead makes a person ritually unclean, which again is unfit for sacred space. And so in this chapter, the issue comes up, well, what about the priests? Because the priests, you know, are in some way responsible ritually with, again, sanctifying people in this situation. They're invariably going to be in contact with the dead because, again, of the distress of someone dying. And, you know, they may ask a priest to come over and, you know, comfort them or do this or that. So they're in need of some special commentary for, you know, what happens with the priests. And what we have here in the first four verses gets us into initially the ordinary priest. In other words, the first four verses here are dealing with just your run-of-the-mill priest, not the high priest. The high priest is going to come later and have even stricter rules. But in the first four verses here, we get the parameters for whether a priest can willingly Okay, make himself unclean with respect to contact with a dead relative. And again, there's a list of what's allowable here. There's a similar verse in Ezekiel 44 that says, this is verse 25, Ezekiel 44, 25, a priest shall not defile himself by entering a house where there is a dead person. Again, because you're a priest, you know, you have, your job is to occupy sacred space and do things. So, you know, you shouldn't just go into this situation where you could be defiled, okay? But the exception occurs again in Ezekiel 44. The rest of the verse says, he shall defile himself only for the sake of father or mother, son or daughter, brother or unmarried sister. So it mimics the situation here that we just read in Leviticus 21. So if we go back to that, in the very first verse, no one shall make himself, again, speak to the priests, no one shall make himself unclean for the dead among his people. Okay, the word Hebrew for people is am, which again can be an entire people group, an entire nation, or more limited group. But here in this context, it's obviously a reference to somebody's near kin. And so the principle laid down is generally priests should not go into homes where there's a dead person. Okay, you're just going to be defiled. And your job is in sacred space, so then you know that's going to just mess things up. But for the ordinary priest, if it's father, mother, son, daughter, brother, unmarried, sister, okay. It's okay to enter that house, comfort people. You know, whereas before, this is something you shouldn't do, even though people might want you to do, or you might think your duty as a priest, you know, might involve this. Don't defile yourself by contacting the dead. Don't enter a house where there's a dead person, except, you know, in this situation, this narrow group. So as a general rule, an ordinary priest should not become defiled by contact with the dead, even of his own extended clan, but only for the members of his clan who are the most closely related to him, and again, his immediate family. So it's an issue because attending the burial of clan relatives was sort of a traditional thing to do in the culture. But the priests here are actually a little bit restricted from doing that. They can only do that in certain situations. So right away, again, we're starting off, and I think it was important to mention that because Leviticus 21 very clearly, again, is in a context of priestly duties, sacred space, again, something religious. Let's just be as broad as we possibly can. There's a religious context to what we're reading now in Leviticus 21. And if we want to use the word, a ritual context, a priestly context, so whatever the vocabulary is we want to use. Now that becomes an important setup. It helps us, again, get the flow of things for when we hit verse 5. Leviticus 21:5 says, they, again, the priests, because that's who he's talking to, speak to the priests in verse 1. They shall not make bald patches on their heads, nor shave off the edges of their beards, nor make any cuts on their body. Now, this is a verse that typically comes up with the tattooing situation. So right away, the context for this is, we're talking about priests here. We're not talking about anybody in general. We're talking about priests. That's the first thing. But this comment in Leviticus 21:5, notice what's grouped here. Make bald patches on the heads, shave off the edge of the beards, or make any cuts on their body. Now that harkens back to Leviticus 19. And I didn't bring this up in the previous episode, but we'll pick it up here. Let's just get a few verses, you know, the cluster of verses here. And you can see where the same kind of language, where it falls into here. Leviticus 19, 26 to 29 says this, you shall not eat any flesh with the blood in it. You shall not interpret omens or tell fortunes. You shall not round off the hair on your temples, nor mar the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuts on your body for the dead or tattoo yourselves. This is the ESV. I am the Lord. Do not profane your daughter by making her a prostitute, lest the land fall into prostitution and the land become full of depravity. Okay, so this, it's grouped in here with a bunch of other rules. And the eating of the flesh, again, the blood of an animal was only, you know, blood of a sacrifice was only for God. Blood was really only for God. We talked about how, you know, people would have to bury it, put dirt over it so that it couldn't be used in ritual purpose. We talked about that in the last episode. The life force belongs to God. It goes back to God. That's the idea. That's why you shouldn't consume blood. then we go from that to interpreting omens or telling fortunes. Again, treading on the area of divine knowledge, sacred space, really the other world, the spiritual world, you know, contacting beings who inhabit that world to get special divine information. You're not supposed to do that. And we talked about that a little bit last time, what the logic is. And then we get right after that, Leviticus 19, don't round the hair off your temples or mar the edges of your beard. Don't make cuts on your body or tattoo yourselves. Okay, and then we go to profane your daughter by making her a prostitute. Again, a lot of scholars think that refers to sacred prostitution. In other words, you don't have your daughter function as a cultic prostitute. I mean, generally a prostitute would be bad too, but since this is in the context of this other religious stuff, again, this is an oblique reference to sort of idolatry, some of the things that the Canaanites did. Yeah, and I want you to get the flavor that this is not just so broad and wide. There is a religious reason. There's a religious flavor, a context for these laws that has something to do with your vow, your status as the people of Yahweh to have only Him as your God. There are certain things you do not do religiously because the Canaanites do that. The Egyptians do this stuff. You know, fill in the blank. Somebody else does this. Someone else who's loyal to another God does these things. And as we're going to see here with the quote tattoo question, there's a consistent, again, ritualistic religious flavor to these commands in Leviticus. So let's just jump in here full bore, you know, with this whole question. So I'd start by saying this again, just to make the point again. The context of Leviticus 19, and here we're in Leviticus 21. So 21 verse 5, I think is pretty clear. The practices listed are all associated in some way with religious practices practiced by pagans. Okay, there's this context. We don't do this in, you know, as a follower of Yahweh. We don't do this as a priest of Yahweh, because people who have other gods and worship them and do certain rituals for them do these things. We're not going to do them. They do. We are, again, maintaining a separation between us and them because of our loyalty to Yahweh of Israel over against other gods. So the practices listed here are all associated in some way with other religions, idolatrous rites. And everything listed here was well known in the ancient world as having that context, having something to do with, again, what an Israelite would look at and say is an idolatrous ritual, some divination practice or some ritual conducted. And that's, again, at the heart of why these things are prohibited. So if you go to Leviticus 19, you go through the list, consumption of blood. Again, we talked about that. You don't use blood ritualistically. Blood belongs to Yahweh because it's a life force. Well, other pagan religions, they did lots of things with blood, you know, to their gods, that sort of thing. So again, the law wants to hem that in. Maintain loyalty to Yahweh. Don't consume the blood. You know, don't do what these other people do. Then there was interpreting omens, telling fortunes, again, soliciting divine knowledge from other gods, other spirit beings. And then again, rounding off the hair and the beard. Now, as odd as it might sound, in the ancient Near East, hair, as well as blood, as well as semen, some of these other things, symbolized life force. And it did so because it grew. It was perceived as being alive because it grows. Just like a plant, all right? So consequently, people who occupied sacred space, in other words, priests, were not to cut their hair or their beard short. This is one of the bits of logic, part of the rationale that goes into this. It's kind of interesting, but locks of hair have been found, and there are ancient texts outside the Bible that describe the practice, but hair has been found laid in tombs, put on funeral pyres, again, in ancient Syria, you know, some of these other archaeological sites. Hair is described as being brought to sanctuaries, temples as part of dedicatory offerings to some god. Again, it was just because of the way it was perceived. And again, you know, we have a religious context. Now, for those of you, I'm not going to get into 1 Corinthians 11 again, but for those of you that I sent those articles to that asked for them, this ought to sound familiar right now, because even in the 1 Corinthians 11, the head covering thing, that whole situation, the hair was the key to understanding what Paul is thinking when he's talking about the woman's head covering in 1 Corinthians 11. It had something to do with life force, with fecundity, with the ability to conceive children. And again, as odd as that sounds to us, this is part of ancient thinking, ancient, you know, pre-scientific thinking, ancient religious thinking. So the hair trimming described, again, would also be something associated with pagans, because they would take that hair and make it part of an offering, or they would make it part of a mourning ritual or some other temple ritual. And so the rule is, don't do that. Don't round off the side growth of your head. You know, don't do this kind of stuff. You're not supposed to do it because of the religious denotation and connotation. The fourth item, don't cut. Don't make cuts in your flesh, or, you know, cutting marks on your body for the dead. Okay, did we catch that? Now, in back in Leviticus 19, let's just go there. It adds that detail. It says in verse 28, you shall not make any cuts on your body for the dead, or tattoo yourselves, I am the Lord. Now, Leviticus 21:5, it's more abbreviated. Don't make bald patches on their heads. The priests shouldn't shave the edges of their beards, and they shouldn't make any cuts on their body. They shall be holy to their God, verse 6, and not profane the name of their God. For they offer the Lord's food offerings, the bread of their God, therefore they shall be holy. Again, they shall be, you know, restricted. You know, it's about maintaining fidelity to Yahweh. But let's just go back to this cutting the marks, you know, cutting or marking yourself on the body for the dead. Now, sure, you can look at that and sort of ignore the context for the dead or whatever, because right away that tells us that takes us into mourning rituals, which is an inherently religious thing. And again, the belief that the ancestors lived on, that we, you know, and you know, we think this way too. You know, we believe in an afterlife. The ancient person certainly did, whether they were pagan or Israelite. So you would take offerings, you know, to tombs. You would take offerings, you know, to where your dead loved ones were. You know, and we do this thing too. We leave flowers. We leave little tokens. You know, and again, it's to maintain, you know, some sort of quote unquote, you know, contact, maintain the relationship, so to speak, with the dead. Well, the ancients did this too, but again, they actually thought that what they left there was actually going to be used, food offerings, drink offerings in some way. This whole idea of an ancestor cult or a cult of the dead, you know, scholars will use that kind of terminology and it sounds like a zombie movie or something, but it's a little less dramatic than that. But you assume that your ancestor would benefit in some way, that you were contributing to their existence on the other side. And so any kind of mourning ritual, any kind of dedicatory offering or mourning offering, you know, you're mourning your dead, that kind of thing, was an inherently religious thing that involved what you believed about who's in charge of the underworld. You know, what God you're worshiping, what you believe about your relationship to spirit beings. And for the Israelite, look, there's only one conduit for this. It's Yahweh of Israel. And if you want information, you go to the high priest, he does the Urim and the Thummim thing, or the Ephod. I mean, there, or you talk to a prophet. Contact with the other side was very circumscribed and funneled through Yahweh himself, or agents that Yahweh had designated as being permissible agents, using permissible means to communicate with him or to discern or divine the will of God, casting lots, that sort of thing. So all of these things, again, are inherently religious. And if Yahweh's telling you not to do it and you're doing it, it's inherently idolatrous. So that's really how we need to be thinking about this. So how do we know, though, that cutting the hair or cutting, you know, your flesh, do we know for sure, again, that this was part of idolatry? Well, the answer is, yeah, we do. The Bible tells us that it was associated. These things were associated with, again, mourning rituals, which are inherently religious. Jeremiah 16:6 says, both great and small shall die in this land. They shall not be buried. No one shall lament for them or cut himself or make himself bald for them. There you have both the things, you know, bald spots on the head, cutting your flesh. These were mourning rituals. Again, and the principle here of Leviticus is, we don't do this here. The pagans do this kind of stuff. We don't do this. There's an association with pagan idolatry. Yeah, so this isn't a coincidence. You know, the connection between Jeremiah 16, Leviticus 19, Leviticus 21, this is not a coincidence. This is how it was perceived. You could go to Deuteronomy 14:1. Again, there's another one. You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or make any baldness on your foreheads for the dead. Don't do this. And again, it's inherently associated with mourning ritual. Don't do this. So as mourning practices, again, inherently religious practices, pagan religious practices, that's how we need to be reading this text. We shouldn't be thinking of modern tattooing, getting a little flower on my hand or something like that. Again, there's an immediate context. So we have to judge what's being done by, you know, hey, maybe somebody who walks into a tattoo parlor is doing the, you know, I want a picture of Satan. I want a picture of this deity, or I'm doing this, you know, for some religious ritual, you know, who knows? That certainly can happen, but that's not inherent to the situation as we know it today. Back in the Israelite time, there was no ambiguity there. This is why you did these things. Probably the classic passage is 1 Kings 18 on this, you know, the prophets of Baal and Elijah confronting the prophets of Baal. And, you know, again, we know the story, you know, about how they're trying to, you know, the God who sends fire and all this kind of stuff, he's God. We know the story. I'm not going to read the whole story, but there's part of it in 1 Kings 18, 28, where we read that the prophets of Baal cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. So cutting was also used in other ritualistic contexts. It wasn't just mourning, even though that's pretty clear, but they cut themselves, the prophets of Baal, after their custom. In other words, this was part of the worship of Baal. Now, I'm going to read a little selection here from the Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible that deals with, again, this episode. It reads like this. In the Ugaritic texts, we find a cult cry. So you actually read this in Ugaritic texts. And of course, Baal was, you know, the co-regent of El in Ugaritic religion. Baal was really important. The Baal cycle is part of the Ugaritic text. So Baal's an important deity. So in the Ugaritic texts, we find a cult cry. And here's the phrase. Where is mightiest Baal? Where is the prince, lord of earth? By the way, that's Prince's Zabul. Lord of Earth, you know, the Baal Arits, that kind of thing. So Baal Zabul, Baal Prince, is where we get that. So, you know, you kind of know where that's going to end up. But anyway, this Ugaritic text says, where is mightiest Baal? Where is the Prince, the Lord of the Earth? The article continues, the ecstasy of these prophets is reminiscent of the prophetic ecstasy reported in the tale of Wen Amon. This is an Egyptian text. There are other extra-biblical parallels, too. Of the self-mutilation of the ecstatic Baal worshippers in 1 Kings 18, as was their custom, we also have parallels in Ugaritic texts. Quote, and this comes from an Ugaritic text, KTU 1.5, column 6, lines 20 and 22, it says, he, again the priest, harrowed his collarbone. He plowed his chest like a garden. He harrowed his waist like a valley. Ouch. Okay. So they're serious. I mean, they're cutting themselves in ecstatic worship of Baal. This was part of Baal religion, and that's what we have alluded to back in 1 Kings 18. So the cutting of the flesh. Again, it's the same terminology that we read back in Leviticus. So are we really talking about tattooing here? Are we talking about some religious ritual? Well, I think it's pretty obvious we're talking about the latter. So like I said, yeah, you can pull these texts out of Leviticus and say, oh, well, this is a condemnation of, again, the tattoo artist or something like that. But to do that is really to rip it out of its context. There's a couple things I can provide for listeners here. There's some of what I just read actually appears in an article by a guy named J.J. M. Roberts called A New Parallel to 1 Kings 18, 28, and 29. Again, it's about prophets bathing themselves in their own blood and all this kind of stuff in parallel to 1 Kings 18. I can have Trey put that up on the website. People are interested in that kind of material. They can read it. Again, I want you to know that this is the context for it. Go back into the primary text. This is what you find. So I would, you know, where is this going? I would say it this way. Unless you want to argue that, again, we don't really need to pay attention to context, which I think for this audience is probably approximates blasphemy, because again, I'm big on interpreting the Bible in light of its own context. So unless you're not willing to do that, if you just want to throw context out, well, yeah, then, you know, take these verses in Leviticus and make them about tattoo parlors, but it's really going to miss the point. What they're really about is loyalty to Yahweh. What they're really about is fidelity here with respect to the priests. We do the rituals Yahweh says we can do, and the ones he says not to do, we don't do. We are creating distinction between us, the way Yahweh is worshipped, the meaning that we attach to things like blood and hair and hair and all this kind of. I mean, we are circumscribing how we view these things, how we view the world, how we view ourselves, how we view the other side, how we view spiritual beings, how we view the other gods against Yahweh. How we view all these things dictates to us what we do and what we don't do in a ritual context, so that by obeying these things, we make it very clear that we're different, that we're aligning ourselves with not only a different God, but only one God, and that is Yahweh of Israel. And we live by his laws. We're thinking about the world that he made the way he wants us to think about it. And we're thinking about our relationship to him and other spiritual powers in a very specific way. He is the lone access, the lone conduit for true knowledge about the other side, about what goes on in the spirit world. We're avoiding doing anything that would solicit contact with other deities, or that would allow people to presume that we think other deities are a good source of information, or that they're worthy of any worship, because they're not in both respects. Now, there's another issue here that we need to talk about with cutting. And this one actually even includes writing on your flesh. And that is, the ancient world had another purpose outside of religious for it wasn't totally divorced from religion, but it could be. It could be quote-unquote secular. The ancient world, marking the flesh either by cutting it or by writing on it, also had the connotation of slavery. And this gets into parts of Leviticus, you know, when they were written, you know, different parts of the Torah, what was done with slaves and all that sort of thing. So we have, again, situations where, because of the surrounding culture, again, depending on the time of history, where cutting and writing on the flesh was used to indicate, to mark a slave. I have a quotation here from Milgram from his Leviticus commentary, and he writes this: "The prohibition of tattoos bans the legally accepted practice of marking a perpetual Israelite slave." So there were ways to mark slaves. Remember Exodus 21, the slave would put his ear up against the post and you would drive an awl through it. Well, that put a little hole in the ear, and that was a mark that this person, again, had willingly decided, "I want to be, you know, associated with this household forever," that kind of thing. This fact alone should indicate that the Holiness Code abolishes the statute of perpetual slavery entirely. Since, again, the Holiness Code maintains perpetual slavery for a resident alien or foreigner, we can presume that it also permitted such slaves to be tattooed, again, in certain contexts, just like the driving, you know, driving through the awl. So this is an instance where marking a person, in this case, by driving, you know, the awl through their ear, was something you did to a servant, in this case, a servant who wanted to join the household more permanently. Okay, that we get that. That was okay. But sometimes there are laws in Leviticus that forbid doing this kind of thing, such as, you know, cutting the flesh, you know, tattooing, that kind of thing. And his point is, in the passage, in Exodus 21 is when you get this law about the perpetual slave. And in Deuteronomy 15 and some other passages, it changes. So the idea of marking slaves, marking people in perpetuity as slaves or as servants of the household, that fades out of Israelite life and culture, and it even fades out of the Israelite law as time moves on. So Milgram's point is that the Torah allowed for some of this, and culturally everybody knew what was going on. The person marked was a slave, but eventually, again, that fades out of Israelite culture. Good enough. The Code of Hammurabi mentions the same thing. Slaves were branded in Babylonia. Sometimes their hair was cut, their heads were shaved. I'll just read you a section here from the Anchor Bible Dictionary about Hammurabi's policy here. The Code of Hammurabi, paragraph 282, permitted the master to cut off the ear of a disobedient slave. In Mesopotamia, starting with the end of the third millennium, many slaves were already being marked with marks of the abutum type, Akkadian word there. This was probably a special mark placed on the shaven head by a barber who also functioned as the professional marker of slaves. According to the Code of Hammurabi, paragraph 226, if a barber shaved this particular mark from a slave's head without the knowledge and consent of the owner, the barber's hand could be cut off. So it was a serious thing to not mar or distort or erase marks put on certain people. And again, in the culture, everybody knew that that person who was marked, who either had something drawn on them or something branded on them, or, you know, again, something with the hair. There were things you did to the body to mark the person as a slave. So again, where does this leave us? You go back to the tattoo issue. To use these verses to condemn tattooing just en toto, completely, you have to assume two logical leaps now. You have to assume that the tattooing is about idolatry. Again, you have to assume that it involves the worship or some ritual of another god. Or you have to assume that the person who's getting the tattoo is a slave, or the person giving a tattoo is marking a slave. Again, the context just don't fit. So unless tattoo artists are branding people for slavery or cutting someone or themselves as part of mourning rituals associated with the worship of foreign gods, modern tattooing doesn't mimic, it doesn't fit contextually with what's condemned in Leviticus and other passages. Again, I don't think we need to prayerfully consider why we're getting a haircut or again, what we're doing with the hair that is cut, or by analogy here, what, you know, if somebody wants to get a tattoo, I mean, I guess you could ask them. And if you have a person that says, hey, I'm doing this because I serve Satan, or well, that, you know, that's something I think that can clearly be condemned if you're a tattoo artist. I mean, I know Christian tattoo artists that they actually do question people. And if there's some religious connotation going on, they won't do it. Again, because they're a little more familiar, they've actually spent a little more time thinking about what the context for the commands are, and they want to stay clear of aiding and abetting someone to worship a false god, you know, a foreign god, a god that is lesser than Yahweh, a being that, you know, is relatively speaking when it comes to Yahweh, a flunky, right? They take care, actually, to be circumspect in their own, you know, industry. Again, that's not common a lot, but there are, again, Christians who obviously get tattoos, obviously do tattooing, and it just doesn't work to blanket condemn the practice based on these Leviticus passages. I mean, you can talk about it other ways. You talk about it. Is it wise? You can't get it removed. You know, are you wasting your money? I mean, there are other ways to talk about the wisdom, making it a wisdom issue. That, you know, that's certainly on the table. But to actually just use Leviticus for this really doesn't honor the context that's going on, but it can have an overlapping application. So if you know people, you know, who want to get a tattoo, again, my first question would be, why? Why are you doing it? And you might want to ask them. You might want to bring this kind of material up and say, you know, this is the way it could be perceived. You know, who knows? Or, I just want to make sure that you're not thinking this. You know, we're not going to do anything demonic here. You know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, those are conversations you can have, but there is no one-to-one correspondence between these Leviticus passages and, you know, what we have going on today. Now, I'll give Trey another article. It's by a guy named Gilad Gavaryahu. And it's specifically on Leviticus 19:28, and it's about tattooing and branding. It's from the journal, the Jewish Bible Quarterly. So it's Ketovet Ka'aka, Leviticus 19:28, is it tattooing or branding, that kind of thing. So if you want to do some background reading in this sort of thing, you might find it interesting. But I figured, you know, we hit this, might as well say something about it because I get this question, you know, not a lot, but I've probably gotten it half a dozen times. So I figured it was worth discussing here. Let's move on to, I will just go to verse 7. The priests shall not marry a prostitute or a woman who has been defiled. Neither shall they marry a woman divorced from her husband, for the priest is holy to his God. You shall sanctify him, for he offers the bread of your God. He shall be holy to you. The Lord who sanctifies you, I the Lord who sanctify you am holy. Okay, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by whoring, profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. So it's a capital offense. And again, the whoring there, it might be general. It's certainly going to be cultic prostitution, or at least that possibility has to be wrapped into this. But again, this is something talking about willful prostitution in verse 9. But let's go back to verse 7, defiled by whoring, by harlotry. You know, and this whole thing about, you know, the priest can't marry a woman divorced from her husband, all that kind of stuff. Well, verse 7, again, the whoring translation, or harlotry, again, depending on what your translation is the Hebrew word zonah, which is a term that is typically applied to a woman who is habitually given to prostitution and not to a woman who may have had a moral lapse on a particular occasion. Zonah is used throughout the prophets of cultic prostitution and just general prostitution. Again, somebody who habitually exchanges sex for money. Again, it's not someone who had a moral failure on one occasion. So that the two are not the same by virtue of the vocabulary. But then we have this line about, you know, one divorced from her husband. You know, what's that about? Well, the priestly marriage, again, we haven't gotten to the high priest yet because it's even stricter there, but the priestly marriage represents an ideal. Again, the priests have greater sanctity. They penetrate sacred space further than the normal person does. So the rules for them are going to be generally more restrictive than the rest of the population. For instance, if you go to Deuteronomy 24, and this is the famous passage about the whole what's a cause for divorce. This passage always comes up. It says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. And of course, the debate is, what's an indecency? Does that mean adultery, some sort of sexual infidelity, or like anything he doesn't like? This goes into the Gospels with the Jewish debate on when is it lawful to divorce. And this is what the Pharisees, you know, throw at Jesus, because they want to know what he thinks here. So if the man has found some indecency in her, he and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house. If she goes and becomes another man's wife, and then the latter man hates her and writes her, you know, a certificate of divorcement, then the first man, you know, wrapping up here, isn't allowed to take the woman back. Well, did you notice in verse 2 that there's no condemnation for just generally Joe Israelite to marry this woman? The second man can marry this woman, all right? So when we go back to Leviticus, the point of the Levitical law here is that for priests, you can't do that. The standard for priests is more restrictive than the general Israelite. And when we get to the high priest in a few moments, it's even more restrictive. So again, there's a teaching point here. So the laws are supposed to convey, again, this idea that the ideal, you know, there's an ideal here for the marital couple. And of course, there's an that's the culture is going to, you know, contribute to that as well. But there's an ideal here. And so the closer to the presence of God we get, the more restrictive, you know, this sort of thing is going to be, again, to reflect, again, holiness, to reflect the ideal, the perfection, or, you know, or the near perfection. I'm trying to think of a better word for that. You know, sort of getting back to the original marital couple. They were innocent. They were pure. That kind of thing. That kind of thinking. So the idea is that we make things more restrictive for the people who are closer to the presence of God in terms of the sacred space they're allowed to occupy. And so when we get to the high priest, I'll just read it here. He has the high priest begins in verse 10, the priest who is chief among his brothers. Again, an expression referring to the high priest. He is not allowed to go into any dead bodies, even for his father or his mother. That's verse 11. So there's a restriction there greater than the normal priest. Verse 12, he shall not go out of the sanctuary, lest he profane the sanctuary of his God, for the consecration of the anointing oil of his God is on him. I am the Lord. And he shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman or a woman who has been defiled or a prostitute. These he shall not marry, but he shall take as his wife a virgin of his own people. And so it actually tightens the restriction for the high priest. And again, it's just about a teaching point. It's not that, oh, you know, he's better and the women are worse or anything like that, because the normal Israelites had less restrictions. But the high priest, he can't even go to the funeral of his mom and dad. He has to marry a virgin. Again, and it's because of his proximity on sacred space to, again, the most holy place and the holy presence. Again, it just ups the ante for him in this case. It's the same kind of logic that when you go beyond these rules for the high priest and you get to Leviticus 21, 16 through 24, that's the end of the chapter. This is the part in Leviticus where we have a list of people who are excluded from sacred space. Okay, I'll just start off here. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron, of course, Aaron's the high priest, saying, none of your offspring throughout their generations who has a blemish may approach to offer the bread of his God. Again, it's a reference to where, you know, the bread is kept in the holy place and all that. For no one who has a blemish shall draw near, a man blind or lame, or one who has a mutilated face, or a limb too long, or a man who has an injured foot, or an injured hand, or a hunchback, or a dwarf, or a man with a defect in his sight, you know, has something wrong with his eye, or an itching disease, or scabs, or crushed testicles. No man of the offspring of Aaron the priest who has a blemish, any blemish, shall come near to offer the Lord's food offerings, since he has a blemish. He shall not come near to offer the bread of his God. He may eat the bread of his God, both of the most holy and the holy things, but he shall not go through the veil or approach the altar, because he has a blemish, that he may not profane my sanctuaries. For I am the Lord who sanctifies him. So Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the people of Israel. And that's the end of Leviticus 21. Again, what's the point? The point is not sin. The point is not moral inferiority. The point is not there's something wrong with you in a spiritual sense. The point is wholeness must be associated with the divine presence. Okay, the whole idea of excluding someone whose body was not whole, was not complete, again, was not the way it was, God had made it. Again, there's something wrong with it. The whole point of excluding that person from, and we're talking here to the priest, but it's going to apply more generally too. But the point of excluding that person, even if they're a priest, from sacred space is that the presence of God is associated with life and with wholeness, with completeness, with the way things ought to be. And so it teaches people, when we exclude these people, we are reminded of the completeness, of the perfection, of the wholeness of God, that where He is, and Lord willing, someday we will be with Him after we die, because He is in covenant relationship with us, and we worship no other besides Him. Okay, we believe that He is who He is, and that what He has said, that He loves us, that He will redeem us, through these things that He's asking us to do. When we are with Him, then we will be whole. We will lose these blemishes, because in His presence, these things don't exist. They're not tolerated. Where He is, there is perfection and completeness and wholeness, and life is what it should always have been and what He intended it to be. Again, these are theological teaching points. Now, the priest who is excluded from conducting any of these offerings because of some personal blemish, bodily blemish, he was still allowed to eat. He still got a portion of the sacrifices. A physically defective priest was only kept out or kept away from officiating, from conducting, the rituals. He wasn't denied the sustenance due to him as a priest. Again, the intent was only to prevent his presence in the holy area, sacred space. The intent was not to deprive him of what he needed to live. That is not part of the law at all. So the priest is still allowed to participate in terms of what is due to him from his portion of the sacrifices and whatnot. It's just about sacred space. He's not being punished for anything. There's a teaching point here that we just talked about. Now, if we drift into Leviticus 22, generally speaking here, I'm not going to say a whole lot in Leviticus 22 because there's a lot of repetition about earlier holiness laws. But in the first two verses we read, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons so that they abstain from the holy things of the people of Israel, which they dedicate to me, so that they do not profane my holy name. I am the Lord." Now, what this is about is it's an instruction to Aaron, he's the high priest, and his sons, the priests, to be very careful about what happens to food items that are donated, that are dedicated, either sacrificially or through peace offerings or whatever. They have to be scrupulous about taking any of that for themselves, because if they're given to God, they're God's. So this is just a sort of, it's not the first time that they've been warned, but again, there's a little bit of repetition here. But this is about sacred donations, sacred offerings that the priests, Aaron and his sons, have to be careful that they don't steal from God, is the point. We get down to verses 10 through 14. Let's just read them. We read this: "A lay person," and this is a non-priest, "a lay person shall not eat of a holy thing." Okay, he's not supposed to have any of it either. "No foreign guest of the priest or hired worker shall eat of a holy thing." In other words, if it's dedicated to God, you don't eat it. "But if a priest buys a slave as his property for money, the slave may eat of it," again, because he's sort of attached to the priest's household. Okay, again, whatever the priest gets, again, whatever the priestly portion is, those in his household may eat. But if there's a portion that's been given exclusively over to God, that you don't eat. Again, the rules here again are just who is part of the priest's family, who can eat part of the priest's portions, and even the priests themselves. Look, you don't eat what's God's. What is given to you, only you and those in your immediate family may eat, because again, we want to distinguish you from the non-priest, and we also want to distinguish God from all of you. Again, it's about this distinction, this quote unquote holiness, which is again, there are things that are set aside, set apart for God, and that means they are off limits to others, to anybody else. Now, if somebody makes a mistake, Verse 14, if anyone eats of a holy thing unintentionally, he shall add the fifth of its value to it and give the holy thing to the priest. So, you know, if something that was designated for the priest is somebody who shouldn't eat that, eats it, well, they have to restore it and add one-fifth to it. So they're penalized for it. So again, we've seen some of these laws before about not stealing from God, making sure, again, you do these rules to reinforce. And this is the whole logic of Leviticus here. We're doing these things to enforce the idea that God is different from us. He is different than we are. He is superior to us. He is completely holy. We're just trying to be holy, not so that he'll love us. He already loves us. He's already chosen to be in covenant with us. We're the descendants of Abraham. Okay, we're doing this to honor him, to show that we do believe that he is the God of gods, to show that we do believe that he has entered into a covenant relationship with us, to show that we do believe that he supernaturally enabled Abraham and Sarah to have a kid, and we're the result. Okay, we do believe these things, and we align ourselves with the God of Israel. So we are doing these things to distinguish him from us. And really, you've got God, you've got the priesthood, and within the priesthood, you've got the high priest distinguished from the other priest. Then you have the laity, you have the community. There are things that tie them together. We talked in the last episode about the blue thread running through everybody's garment. Again, it was supposed to remind them of something. Okay, there are ways that the community, you know, participates in the system. There are ways that the community is kept apart from the system. So again, without, you know, repeating earlier content, this is the logic of Leviticus. It's not about, oh, this group of people is better than this other group of people. This group of people sins less than this other group of people. That is to misunderstand the whole logic of it. The logic is to elevate the Holy One and set him apart from all others. They have to be, everybody else except for him has to be made fit for sacred space. He, by definition, is fit for sacred space. Where he is sacred space from the get-go. Everybody else has to be prepared for it, lest they contaminate it. And so these laws of exclusion and inclusion just reinforce the idea. I wanted to make one comment before we're done here. Again, because a lot of Leviticus 22 is repetitive to places we've been before. And we'll find that's going to be the case with later episodes too as we finish up the book. But in verse, let's see here. Let's just go to verse 26. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, when an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain 7 days with its mother. And from the eighth day on, it shall be acceptable as a food offering to the Lord. But you shall not kill an ox or a sheep and her young in one day or in the same day. And when you sacrifice a sacrifice of thanksgiving to the Lord, you shall sacrifice it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten on the same day. You shall leave none of it until morning. Again, that's old regulation. But I wanted to mention this law about, you know, not using the young of cattle as an immediate sacrifice right after it's born. Levine says this, the law forbids such sacrifice even after, you know, 8 days. Traditionally, this prohibition has been explained as expressing compassion for living creatures. It has been understood to apply only to female animals, the mothers, and their male offspring. You know, the Hebrew is literally its son, beno. Practically speaking, male animals account for the majority of sacrifices anyway. And Levine points out that this is the interpretation that runs through the rabbinic community. And frankly, he doesn't note anything, and I've never come across anything that actually contradicts this in any coherent way. So I just think it's interesting, you know, just sort of as a little thing to pull out of the chapter, that apparently that's why this law is there. Again, to express compassion for living creatures. You say, well, it's not real compassionate if you can eat it after a certain amount of time. Well, the as he says here, most of the sacrifices are males, and the mothers, you know, are and their offspring. The mothers are sort of not off limits, but they're not the focus of the sacrificial item. And when they have young, again, there's this opportunity. I don't want to anthropomorphize or anthropopathize animals, attributing that to them human characteristics or human emotions. Okay, but this does seem to be the logic that the mother and the little baby are allowed to bond. You know, even if they're animals, that this was a token of compassion. Again, I haven't come across anything that's better than that, and that's very consistent, you know, with the stream of Jewish tradition. So make of it what you will. But again, I just thought it was interesting, you know, to mention that this gets thrown in to Leviticus 22 amid all this other stuff. And you know, they wouldn't have to include it, but they do. So what are the takeaways? Again, just to reinforce, I think if we look at these two chapters, we get essentially, you know, two major thoughts by way of, you know, how to think about the chapters for ourselves that we could draw some application out of it. I think one of the big ones is holiness refers to distinctiveness, not doing things the pagans do in the service of their gods, even down to how the Israelites mourned for their dead. It basically, every area of life, I mean, we're here at Leviticus 22 now. We've covered a lot. We've covered sex. We've covered birth. We've covered injuries. We've covered, you know, childbirth, the whole, you know, process there. We, you know, menstruation, just basic what you eat, what you don't eat, you know, where you go, what you do with the carcass, it's just everything in their lives. There was some point to be made about the distinctiveness, the set apartness, the holiness of God. Yahweh of Israel is associated with life, with completeness, with perfection, life as it should be, life as it was intended to be upon its creation, the source of life itself. Again, these are the things that all these really odd rules point to. This God, this being, this creator, okay, is really the thing that ultimately we want to live with and be like and share his living space, to be part of that family in as real a way as possible. Again, mentally, and I talk about this a lot in the unseen realm, not specifically with respect to Leviticus, but mentally, to make people long for the presence of God, because that is where life is. That is where wholeness is. That is where completeness is. That is where every ideal we can imagine is. And he has chosen us by virtue of what he did with Abraham and Sarah, raising us up out of nothing, creating us as a people after he disinherited the nations of the world. He has chosen to be in relationship with us. And he is, through these rules, teaching us about himself and the kind of life that he has and is and dispenses and that we will have if we are loyal to him. Again, this is where the mind of an Israelite would be trained to go. The second lesson, I think, is what belongs to God is God's. We should not treat something associated with him, designated to be his, as ordinary. Because when we do that, that is to express contempt for the sacred. It is to express contempt for what belongs to him as opposed to what, you know, belongs to us. The chapter ends this way, and I think it sort of captures this rationale. Leviticus 22 ends this way. So you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. And you shall not profane my holy name, that I may be sanctified among the people of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. And again, I think that sort of captures the whole logic, the rationale, and those two big takeaways, if you will. And not only from these two chapters, but really from the book as we've gone through it.
Mike, can you briefly elaborate on the buying of slaves in Leviticus 22:11, or touch on that practice in those times?
Well, there were a variety of places and means and costs, again, to buying a slave. There are other laws, like in Exodus and Deuteronomy, about, I hate to put it this way, who the candidates for slavery were. Slave here, again, it's a generic term, you know, to buy, to acquire. Kana is a word that the noun for slave doesn't even occur here. It's just if a priest acquires someone as a property, the slave later in the verse, again, the acquisition, you know, may eat of his food because he's a member of his house. So it's talking about a person in context, which is why it's translated the way it is. In other passages, we have eved is the common word for slave or servant. There were different categories. If you were a non-Israelite, there could be slaves who were captives, slaves or servants, again, captives of war. We have this with the conquest situation, for example, with the Gibeonites. They were made workers in the community because they tricked Joshua into signing a covenant with them. So there was that situation. There's no like racial component to it. It's typically a wartime situation, a foreign enemy kind of situation. But slaves were supposed to be set free after a certain amount of time. We're going to get into that later in Leviticus. If you were an Israelite, you might be a slave slash servant in the sense of an indentured servant to pay off a debt. And this is these are really the focus of a lot of the Jubilee regulations that an Israelite especially was only allowed to be a servant for a certain amount of time. But even a foreigner, you know, who maybe either sold himself into servitude, again, to make a living. People did that. That was very common in the ancient world. It wasn't always a violent, unwillful thing. This was just like in later European history, this was a way to survive for many people. I will be your servant for X number of years. If you take care of me, I will do X, Y, Z, you know, service to you and that sort of thing. But it could be on the negative side too, like a war situation or an enemy situation, a captive situation. So you get both varieties, but even with the foreigner, if the foreigner wanted to stay beyond his term, you know, as we talked about a little bit in this episode, the foreigner could go to his master and say, well, I know my time is up, but hey, I got married and my wife is here and you know, she's also, you know, maybe an indentured servant and I don't want to leave her. Can I stay? And you could work that out. Or you could say, I want to stay for good. I want to be a member of your household. I like my situation. I like you. I like my master. And so then they would go through the all ceremony and whatnot. So there were a lot of different circumstances, a lot of different ways people wound up being a servant or a slave. Some of them were negative. Some of them, again, it's not real positive if you have to do this to make a living or pay off a debt. I mean, I'm not trying to portray that as a positive thing, but it's not this violent, coercive thing either. So you have different categories of how people wound up in this situation. And there were rules, you know, what you could, you know, rules in the Torah about which Israelite laws applied to a servant and which didn't. If you were a foreigner visiting in the land, you know, you may or may not be required to participate like in a Passover or something like that. You could be exempt or you would have to do it. It just depended on what the situation was. They reviewed, therefore, in some context, they reviewed equally under the law. Sometimes they reviewed unequally under the law because of their status. So it just depended on the circumstance.
All right. Good deal. Appreciate it. I'm sure we'll be touching on that more.
Yeah, when we get into the Jubilee thing, we'll have to take a look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate it. Do you have a bibliography update for us?
Well, you know, we're here at the beginning of a new year, and the bibliography, of course, those who contributed to the GoFundMe campaign, the $50 level or above, they got basically lifetime access to this thing. So those people have received that information, you know, login, how to use it, you know, how to access the resources there, how to sort and index things. So that lifetime access opportunity is going to officially, I mean, let's just say, you know, officially end on the 3rd of January. That's when I'll actually get time to go and take down the GoFundMe campaign to close that out. Maybe in the future there might be opportunity for, you know, limited access to it in some way that would open up, you know, later on. You know, we'll give that some thought. But as of right now, the project is basically complete. I mean, it's never going to be complete because I'll always be adding things, adding resources to it and tagging those resources. But I never really thought I'd get to this point when I could look at it and say, holy cow, you know, this thing's like, it's done, you know, even though it's never going to be totally done, it's done for all intents and purposes. It's done.
Yeah. And it would not have happened if it wasn't for everybody contributing.
That's right.
We appreciate absolutely right. That and thank
it's,
everybody.
It's just
for
crazy.
That. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. All right, Mike. Well, I also wanted to mention that we're not going to have any transcripts for the conference interviews.
Right.
Mr. Tudor said there's just too much background noise.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that.
And we're going to get better on that. We're going to upgrade our equipment, Mike. So the next time you do that, I'm going to have you set up. So
yeah, we'll have to think about how to do it because the conference floors are busy, bustling. There's just thousands of people there. But, you know, if you can, well, let's put some thought into maybe how to cloister some people or arrange interviews that we can get away from a little bit of the ambient noise.
Absolutely. All right, Mike. Well, next episode, we're going to be doing a Q&A.
Yep, that'll be fun. They always are.
Absolutely. And then we're pretty close to wrapping up Leviticus, so that's good. With the new year, we'll be starting something new, so we'll be listening to that. Is there anything else, Mike,
you'd like to? I can say that something new will be a topic. It will not be a book. I have a short list of three or four possibilities that, you know, we'll jump into a topic. I'm just not quite ready to say what that's going to be yet.
Sounds good. We appreciate it. And I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.